Hi, welcome to Into the Fold, the mental health podcast. I'm your host, Ike Evans, and today we're delighted to bring you episode 145, Social Work in a Time of Division. But first, some mental health headlines. The Hawk Foundation recognizes the month of March as both Women's History Month and Social Workers Month. Currently on our website, you will find a blog post about the amazing Bert Krueger Smith and one of her signature projects during her time at the Hawk Foundation. The Human Condition radio show that ran for over a decade and that we have featured several times on the podcast. And, of course, there is a wealth of information about our founding matriarch, Miss Ima Hogg. Either visit our website, hogg.utexas.edu, or follow us on social media to see our recent posts related to Women's History Month, Women as Changemakers. The history of the Hogg Foundation exemplifies that. Past and present. The same goes for Social Workers Month. This is a time to celebrate the profession of social work, which is near and dear to the Hogg Foundation's goal of expanding the mental health workforce. The theme for Social Work Month 2023 is Social Work Breaks Barriers. Because we have our own stake in highlighting the positive contributions of the profession, we'll soon be publishing a story about our own Ima Hogg scholarships, which gives aspiring social workers a boost into the field. The story will be published on our website in the coming weeks, so be on the lookout for that. In other news, the social media app TikTok announced last week that it is rolling out new usage limits for users under 18 in the United States. This is according to a recent story by National Public Radio. Those safeguards include default settings for users under 13 that require parental permission to continue using the app after 60 minutes on TikTok in one day. Users between the ages of 13 and 17 will be asked to enter their own passcode to continue using TikTok after 60 minutes of daily use. Users under 18 will be asked to set their own usage limits if they opt out of the default settings. There's widespread concern within the mental health field about the impact of social media on the mental health of teens. One mental health professional, Helena Kekmanovic, a psychologist who works with teenagers, is quoted in the story as saying, "Almost every one of our sessions starts with what happened on TikTok or Instagram." In her opinion, the way that our devices and apps encroach on our lives and family time is pernicious, and the new guidelines don't go anywhere near far enough. And that does it for mental health headlines. Don't be left out of the loop. Become a Hogg Insider by subscribing to Mental Health Headlines. You can find a sign-up link on our main website at hogg.utexas.edu. Last month, we took a look at how the current political climate is affecting teachers. Here's a quick sample.
I've always been a strong advocate of mental health and for my students, because I grew up not knowing what anxiety was, not knowing what, you know, whether these things were normal or not. So I just want to make sure, you know, I'm not there to teach them anything that they don't already know. I'm just there to, you know, show them that I love them and I support them. But it does get tiring. And, you know, most recently for me, I had a student who's not even one of my students complain about the rainbow flag. So that was a conversation with HR about needing to relocate it. You know, I did make the case, you know, I understand that there's a student who doesn't appreciate it, but at the same time, I have over a dozen letters from my students telling me, thank you. You know, I feel loved in your classroom. I feel seen. I feel heard. So if it's happening on such a small level, you know, within the students, I'm sure that seeing it on a state level or city level, like a lot of the cities here in Texas are doing, just must be really hard on them. It shouldn't be an issue, but it's unfortunate that they picked such a vulnerable demographic to go after.
That voice that you just heard was Jesus Rosas, a teacher for Richardson Independent School District in Texas, describing what his world has been like since lawmakers began to focus their attention on controlling what can be taught in schools, particularly concerning hot-button topics such as race and LGBTQ plus issues. But we're not done yet. March is Social Work Month, and so we thought it appropriate to devote an episode to how the current climate is impacting this crucial part of the mental health workforce. The debate over gender-affirming care for trans youth is raging against the backdrop of this current Texas legislative session. To an increasing degree, support for LGBTQ plus people is an important practice area for social workers, and the field itself is a magnet for people of LGBTQ plus backgrounds. Something has to give, and that something might be the mental health of social workers and their confidence that they'll be able to continue practicing while the climate for LGBTQ plus people, which includes the care they need, becomes increasingly inhospitable. Joining us today are two practicing social workers. Kimberly Goodwin is a licensed clinical social worker who practices in San Antonio. Among her honors is the 2020 Jonas Award for individuals who go above and beyond to move equality forward for the LGBTQ plus community from PFLAG San Antonio, and a 2014 Innovator in Recovery Award from Via Hope, a former grantee of the Hogg Foundation. And joining her is Kurt Oster, president and CEO of Von Oster Innovation Services, a counseling, coaching, and consulting practice started in Jacksonville and recently expanded to Texas. He is also a licensed clinical social worker. Kimberly and Kurt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you so much.
So I am going to start with a very basic question. How are you two feeling? How would you describe your mood since the year began?
That's a big question with so much happening. I would say energized and ready to go because there's so much work to do, but also appropriately somber.
I would have to agree with Kimberly. Energized, yeah. Ready to go, somber, also keeping my finger on the pulse and watching what is going on. Being NASW Texas's SOG chair, I'm in that unique role where I'm helping watch policy, see what that's going to look like. I'm involved in multiple meetings. So it's also, while energized and okay, we're here, we're doing the work we're doing, we got to keep an eye on things and take temperatures and see what's going on.
Vigilant. Yes.
Yeah. But we know from vigilance has a clear sort of mental health connotation to it. It's not always good for us. And does that monitoring ever get exhausting?
It does, but social workers are agents of change. We are ambassadors to systems change. And at times we may have to be vigilant or watching what's going on, so that we know how to help influence systems change. When I'm in private practice and I'm working with my clients, I need to know what's going on with policy. So I have to be vigilant, because the way I practice may change drastically in a matter of minutes if the legislator passes a policy that could affect the way we provide services for our clients.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I think that vigilance is also only sustainable through community. And, you know, Kurt wisely is involved in NASW. And, you know, I think it's critical for any of us social workers to be involved in community and be engaged in community, not only for serving, but we receive support in knowing that we are doing this work together and not alone, and that we have resources and that we're all supported together with each other.
Can you each share some examples of how the current climate, and in particular the backlash against LGBTQ plus people, because that's not the only backlash, has impacted you professionally?
Yeah, so I work primarily in a private practice, but I also do clinical supervision, and I'm involved with some local nonprofits that serve the community, the Pride Center and Fiesta Youth and PFLAG here in San Antonio. And I think a lot of what I'm seeing is a sense of desperation and urgency in terms of access to care, but also a lot of fear about if I do access care that I need, that is really life-saving, mental health care services, will I be reported to CPS, DFPS? And, you know, will my family be able to be safe? Will I be safe at school? A lot of my clinical supervisees work in a lot of different systems of care in our community, and, you know, seeing what's happening in the child welfare systems in Texas is really disturbing in terms of like youth in foster care, and what their access to gender affirming care or mental health care services looks like, and how it's influenced by legislation, by, you know, fear, by a lot of different things, kind of influenced by all of these laws and statutes. And then my client or my supervisees who are working in hospital systems, who are really struggling with access to care there, coordinating care for, you know, in any kind of area, you know, abuse and family violence, intimate family violence settings, you know, how do we help our clients who are trans receive appropriate care and services and help when they're not a friendly place, a safe place for them to go.
Okay, Kurt, is there anything you'd like to add?
I think Kimberly did a beautiful job summing it up, but also professionally, the impact that is going on professionally is we're seeing this need for professional development, but also very competent professional development. I just came back last week from NASW Louisiana's conference, where I actually taught on LGBT intersectionality and social work practice. And so it's not just us navigating those individual systems, because I'm in private practice. I'm working with clients both in Florida and Texas, seeing the ramifications on both fronts. Pretty much what Kimberly said echoes what I'm dealing with, but also then there is that piece of there's a lot of education we're needing to do, not only for ourselves to stay up with, okay, what's going on, what's changing, but also the education of other professionals and the community. Kimberly was talking about her supervisees. I do a lot of case consultations for our social work community. And much like Kimberly, I have to help social workers navigate those complex systems. And, well, wait, I have a family that might be losing these services. How do we navigate that? And it's a lot of times it's going back to our code. What do we do ethically as social workers at the end of the day? Because that is our driving force. That is our marching orders, is our NASW code of ethics. Yes, we have to follow law, but we also have to be within our code. And our code literally governs our field.
Okay, so Kurt, my next couple of questions are just for you. Kimberly, maybe you can kick back for a few minutes and just chill. Kurt, it seems like your practice is a little bit unique. And that you're set up as an LLC. I just get the sense you're juggling a few different hats. So I just if you tell me a little bit more about what it is that you're doing, you know, in Jacksonville, and I believe Dallas, and kind of more a sense of what your day to day is like.
So I started my private practice, Von Oster Innovation Services, in June of 2022, right in the middle of COVID. Yes, that that was an experience. Started the practice as a mental health counseling, life coaching, and consulting company. I have three unique specializations: neurodivergence, trauma, and LGBTQ on the mental health side. And then on the trauma side, I do a lot of consulting in emergency management consulting, disaster preparedness, working with the business community on continuity of operations, in emergency plans, bringing all of that together in my practice. Literally, my day-to-day is either counseling or consulting. I am a trained play therapist. I work with children. If we were in my office, you would actually see my entire playroom behind me. I'm working from home today, so different ambiance. And about a year ago, I made the decision to also expand to Texas. My best friend is going through his mental health counseling program and was trying to figure out, what am I going to do when I graduate? And I said, I've got an established practice. We work in the same areas. Come join me in the practice. So I expanded the practice to Texas and kind of caught in this whirlwind of, I'm waitlisted Florida, but I'm also waitlisted in Texas. And it's helping me really, as the SOGI chair for NASW, understand where our disparities are. Where are we still needing those services? And so every day I'm sitting down, re-strategizing my approach. I've become a teaching practice. So I have MSW students in my practice learning how to serve the neurodivergent and the LGBT community. And then for me, I also serve on several board of directors for several organizations. And so it's also getting the word out there of supporting minority LGBT businesses, making sure that we're doing a whole community approach. So kind of stealing some of the language from FEMA there on a whole community approach and disaster response, but that we're doing a whole community approach to mental health, to access to services, and making sure that clients are able to get the services that they need without barriers.
Okay, and so let's imagine a parallel universe in which all of those things that you mentioned were still taking place, but without a social worker in the room. Like what? Give me a sense of what would be lacking without someone of your experience, you know, contributing to those kinds of multi-sector efforts.
What would be lacking is the knowledge. Social workers, MSWs, have a very unique training. We are trained to work within systems. We can interface at any level of those systems. And that's what I tell social work students all the time. I hear you're clinical, but you're also going to be doing macro at some point. You will be interfacing in macro. You can't just say, I'm strictly clinical. So when there's not a social worker there, there is that challenge of understanding the whole impact of a system. I say to social workers when I'm teaching them in the emergency management side, we interface at all levels of the disaster process: preparedness, response, recovery, and mitigation. We're not just isolated to one area. So if social work's not at the table, we are missing that critical component of community, but also systems theory and the strengths perspective. We have to have a strengths perspective at the table. Otherwise, are things going to get done? Probably not in a timely manner or in an effective manner.
Okay, great. Okay, so now Kimberly, let's bring you back in. So I just happened to see on your Facebook page that you are acknowledging Social Workers Month as we're trying to do with this episode. And I think their theme for this year is social workers breaking barriers. And so my next question is, you know, what barriers do you come up against as a practitioner? And how do you try to negotiate those?
Yeah, I think that's such a great segue too from what Kurt was just talking about, you know, like the role of social work and how we have a professional imperative, you know, no matter what kind of role we're serving in, to do advocacy and activism. That is a part of being a social worker, no matter what job title that you have. And so in any role a social worker is in, there should be advocacy and breaking barriers happening. And the biggest thing that I see, my tiny individual contribution in all these wonderful group efforts that are happening, that I'm, you know, lucky to be a part of, is exactly also what Kurt was talking about, you know, increasing access to competent care that is based in good research, in evolving research, in lived experience of people who we're providing the services to, and being centered around their needs as expressed by them, you know, and including them in the process of developing services and implementing services. And so my biggest contribution that I feel I focus on personally in my professional career is developing a local workforce here in Texas of really great providers in a variety of areas. But today we're talking about, you know, like the LGBT community. And one of the biggest things with that is working with my clinical supervisees and with UTSA, where I've done some adjunct instructing, and I like to stay a part of that community, to ensure that our local leaders in our community are coming and speaking to social work students. They're part of the MSW program curriculum, where they're coming in and they're helping emerging social workers who will be brand new in our workforce to do good care, to know who they are, to feel that connection and build that network of support. And then my clinical supervisees, part of what I do is I have a partnership with the Pride Center here in San Antonio, where I will waive their clinical supervision fees if they will provide community-based counseling to people who don't have insurance through the Pride Center under great supervision and with a lot of resources and training on best practices. So we're doing it ethically and we're serving people using really good, solid services. And so that's the biggest thing that I'm most passionate about. Very similar to Kurt. I feel like you found two of the same person almost, you know, sort of really enhancing the ability of our whole community, because Texas, you know, is 248 out of 250 of the counties in the state of Texas are health professional shortage areas in the area of mental health treatment. You know, so to begin with, it's bad. And then, you know, a 2022 report by Mental Health America says Texas is last out of every state in the United States in terms of access to care. So there is very little access to care here in Texas. And then once you finally do fight your way in somewhere, is that person competent to provide inclusive, affirming services that you need, or are they going to do conversion therapy? I've had so many clients come to me personally with horrifying experiences with Pray the Gay Away Camp and conversion therapy, and like really horrifying experiences with mental health providers that I then am in a position to have to rebuild trust around.
I'm curious about the mentoring that you're doing of in particular LGBTQ plus social workers, and just what those conversations have to be like with the climate being as inhospitable for them as it has gotten, and what sorts of things you stress to them or that they stress to you, if there's any way to encapsulate that.
I mean, no, absolutely. I think there's a lot, like when you're in, like you mentioned, a fairly inhospitable environment, you know, when you're working with folks who are vulnerable, there's a lot more safety planning involved, a lot more in terms of assessing safety and risk that may not be involved in a more affirming community. You know, so I have a lot of brand new social workers who are like, oh, you know, I can't wait to get my first client and I'm gonna help them come out to their family and I'm just gonna get in there and, you know, we're gonna just like change the world that way. And I, you know, and I have to kind of say, I would never discourage anybody by any means to, you know, express themselves freely, but, you know, I don't want anyone to go in assuming safety when you haven't assessed for that, especially after having done a lot of work with the Thrive Center here in San Antonio, which is for youth, LGBTQ youth who are homeless because they have been turned out from their family homes.
So my next question is, if you could have the ear of policymakers, what would you want them to know about your work in this current climate?
I'll start. Our work, the work of social work, is not going to go away. We are here to help families navigate systems. We are here to help address those mental health concerns. With our training, we are trained in systems. So we are helping these families or clients understand the challenges. We're helping communities. We are helping organizations. I mean, I don't just consult at the community level. I consult businesses. I consult nonprofits. We are that vital key in the table. And we need the voices of all social workers heard. And that we are collectively bound by the same code. And that, so yeah, we're going to have differing views, and our views are going to be great because it's going to help challenge the systems. The way I may look at a system, Kimberly may look at differently, or another social worker may look at differently. But at the end of the day, we're here. We're an asset. We understand the systems, but we are also a profession driven by best practice and research. At the end of the day, that is what we based our practice off of. We are not trying to do this stuff like pray the gay away, conversion therapy, that is not rooted in a deep, rich literature like cognitive behavioral therapy, narrative therapy, gestalt therapy, play therapy, Santre, expressive, dialectical. Those are rooted in literature. We can fill rooms with the literature on them. So that's what I would say to policymakers, is that we're here to lean on. We're here to help you figure out what is best practice. And don't just Google search stuff. Like, throw that out. Ask us. We're the professionals. We're the ones trained to be at the table and understand it.
Yeah, I love that, Kurt, because absolutely, when I'm teaching MSW students, I often talk of social workers as being this connecting piece, right, between the communities that we're serving, and we see how the decisions that are made are really playing out in reality, and we can take that valuable data back to the people who are making these decisions and say, hey, maybe you didn't know or didn't realize these things that you're deciding, this thing that you did, it had all these, like, this is what it's doing, both positively and negatively, right? Like, hey, did you know when you did that, it did this great thing? Or, hey, did you know when you did that, like, a lot of stuff kind of went wrong? And so being able to be that connecting piece and saying, because we see so many people in so many situations that our lawmakers are concerned with, because our lawmakers are concerned with the care of our state and the people in our state. And so being able to make decisions about what will help or harm them, it's important for social workers to be there, because we are right there seeing what it does, what happens, how it plays out in people's lives. And as a, clinical social worker, I'm always going to be focused on mental health too. And, if I could tell lawmakers one thing, it would absolutely be that, mental health care is health care, and it is life-saving care. And 1 in 5 trans youth have attempted suicide, according to the 2022 Trevor Project, compared to 1 in 10 cisgender youth. That's a really huge disparity. And so if we really care about saving lives, if we really care about doing immensely powerful, literally life and death work, or a decision that could make a life or death difference, it's supporting trans youth and doing that suicide prevention on that front end, because there's a lot of research that shows that when trans youth are supported and when they have social support, when they have family support, when they have school support, that goes back down.
All right. So this is now your opportunity to plug whatever it is that you're working on. And so just if there's anything you'd like to mention to our audiences about ways that they can help support or get involved with anything that you are doing or any current projects you have, now's your chance.
So I'll start, the plug I would say to everyone out there is get connected with the organizations. We've got some amazing organizations, Equality Texas, PFLAG, all the different LGBT centers. They're all working together. They're all interconnected. They are all communicating with each other. Equality Texas could literally use help with getting cards to politicians, testimony. NASW is getting involved in that. I'm looking to expand my committee to bring in a diverse perspective, and that it's not just about me as a male calling the shots. I need everyone at the table. And that, and that's really where we have to stop and remember as social workers, is that we all have to be at the table. It's not just one social worker saying, okay, this is what the entire community needs. It's all of us coming to the table saying, hey, we're here. What can we do to get involved? And it's also a lot of that networking and that. So I would challenge the social workers and the mental health professionals that are listening to this to network, to meet others in the field, to say, hey, what is it that you're doing, Kurt? Or hey, Kimberly, what is it that you're doing? Or how can I get involved with supervision with Kimberly? Or Kurt, you're a board certified diplomate. Like, are you available to speak? Kimberly, are you able to speak? So it's also tapping into us as the subject matter people, as the people that are here, and we're on the ground and we're working with the clients and we're navigating these systems and that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really wanted to give a shout out, less so plugging my own stuff, but just saying some of, and to also to end on sort of like a hopeful note, because I think, you know, like it can be so overwhelming and so demoralizing to see so many pressures and stresses and, you know, things that are moving in a direction that is really scary to a lot of people for valid, understandable reasons. But Dr. Ximena Lopez, a medical doctor at Children's Medical Center in Dallas, when Children's Medical Center in Dallas shut down the Genesis program to do gender affirming care for youth, she sued them and said, you can't do that. That's affecting my client's care. And so from a social, even though it's social work month, we're talking about social workers, I was just wanting to bring in all of the people who are doing this really, really impactful work and standing up in really difficult situations and saying, no, those are my patients. You can't do that. You will not block access to care. That's not going to happen. And, you know, the wonderful work that a lot of our agencies, just like Kurt said, you know, that's the biggest thing I would want anyone to do, is you don't have to be a social worker to be helpful. And if you are a social worker, you should be involved in some way. So, getting training. So if you're a social worker yourself, making sure that you have quality, up-to-date training and information about how to provide ethical, safe, inclusive, affirming care. If you're not a social worker, but you want to help, getting involved with any of the amazing efforts that are already happening. You know, in San Antonio, Fiesta Youth, it started in 2013. That was only 10 years ago. And that was the first group, because a parent of a trans kid came to a social worker who's next door right now, Daryl Parsons. He's a clinical social worker as well, and said, hey, you're a social worker. Like, why aren't there any support groups for my kid? The closest one is in Austin. I can't drive an hour every week and my kid needs help. And so the two of them sat at a kitchen table and said, okay, we need to make a support group. And that was 10 years ago. And today it's serving hundreds of teens, and I send lots of my clients there, and everyone I send, you know, their themselves and their family talk about what a difference it makes to have that social support and to see them go from where they were to where they are, you know, after they get connected to that community is incredible. And so you don't have to be anyone in particular to do something amazing. You can use the skills that we have. And I love that Kurt brings that up a lot, because a lot of social workers, I think, need to feel empowered to use the training and skills and knowledge that we have, just like Daryl did, to create this support group in a way that was inclusive and affirming and wonderful and sustainable.
Okay. This has been a pretty wonderful conversation. I hope y'all are feeling good about it. So glad that the two of you could join us. Yeah, it's, I don't know to what extent it's common knowledge, just how big a part of the mental health workforce social workers are. And for a certain strata, you're a lot more likely to find yourself talking to a social worker, you know, than you are like a clinical psychologist. And there are complicated reasons for that. But we really do appreciate it, Kurt and Kimberly. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you for celebrating Social Work Month and doing it by letting us, you know, come talk about stuff that we're excited about.
You're welcome.
Kurt, right. It was great to meet you.
Nice to meet you. I'm going to be emailing you.
Yes, please.
Yes, I was like, where did you find like another me? Like, it's the same, we're doing the same work. How amazing.
Stay in touch, yes.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank right. you.
Bye. So as I've already mentioned, March is Social Workers Month. This is not the first time we've heard from practicing social workers about the challenges that they face when directives from lawmakers clash with their own ethical practice guidelines and their own consciences. Last year, for episode 133, Gender-Affirming Care is Trauma-Informed Care, Eli Lawrence, then a clinical supervisor for Waterloo Counseling here in Austin, had this to say.
So gender affirming is not a nicety. It's not an extra. It's not, you know, something that should be seen as, well, you know, this is like giving a special treat or special, you know, this is life and death. You know, the impact that it has when we refuse to acknowledge, especially teenagers and children, it really can be a matter of life and death.
Okay, and I would think especially as it just seems objectively the case that things are getting less safe.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Even within, you know, Waterloo, as a clinical supervisor, you know, our own staff are just suffering from the secondary trauma of day in, day out, no longer being able to tell somebody, well, I know that you're feeling this, but there's not really any danger. Like, we can't tell our clients that there is real danger. There is persecution. It, you know, myself as a licensed clinical social worker, because of the way that my license is granted by the state of Texas, and because I'm a mandatory reporter, the potential for, if they do actually make it legal to say that it's child abuse to affirm somebody's gender that's minor, I would then be a mandatory reporter, and I would be required by law to either surrender my license, go to jail, or turn in my clients for taking care of their children. You know, I'm looking at it as, what's my next career? Because I can't practice in Texas if that's the law. I can't, there's no way I would be able to do that. Not with any sense of ethics.
I will be including a link to the full episode in today's show notes, so look for that. And that does it for this episode. We're so glad that you could join us. Don't forget that we're always looking for feedback or episode ideas. So email us at intothefold@austin.utexas.edu. Special thanks as always to my colleagues Anna Harris, Kate Rooney, and Daryl Wiggins for their production assistance. And to the Hogg Foundation for their steadfast support. Just as taking care of ourselves enhances our ability to help others, so it is that by helping others, we strengthen our own resilience. And please leave us a review and subscribe to us on the app of your choice. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, TuneIn, among others. Taking us out now is Anna's Good Vibes. Thanks for joining us.